Great meeting you, man. Thank you so much for doing this. How you doing?
Same here. Thank you. I'm doing great. Thank you for having me.
It's my pleasure, and a big shout out to my girl Lisa for making this happen. She's an absolute treasure.
I agree. Thank you.
Thank you. Ralph, I wanted to sort of, I've been a fan of both Frederick Constant and Alpina for the last couple of years especially, and I'm very interested in talking to you today, and I'd first like to know, how did you start in the watch industry?
Well, that was on January 1st, 1999.
Okay.
And that's when I joined the family company, my father's company. And he was at the time distributing watches and jewelry in Holland and in the Netherlands, which is where I'm from originally. I was born and raised there. So I basically grew up around jewelry and watches. I remember in 1984 that IWC was the first brand that my father started to distribute. So that's when my interest was born. But in those days, nobody had ever heard of the brand IWC. And in 1999, I joined the company and I started working initially with Zenith, which was also back in another phase in those days. And then about 2 years later, we also started the distribution of Frederick Constant. So those were my first working years in the exciting watch industry.
That's really interesting from many perspectives, but most importantly, because you know you're not from Switzerland or from France or from Italy, or those neighboring countries, really. So I mean, it's kind of like cool to have that perspective growing up in. Where you grew up.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But actually also growing up there and working in the industry, I mean, I had a great time there and I learned a lot and was very interesting. But it also over the years, because I worked in Holland in the industry for about 8 years, I also discovered more and more that even though it's a beautiful country and I still love going there, but, you know, if you really want to develop a brand... It's nice to be in a more sizable country where you can actually really do different things in different parts of the country. And considering the fact that Holland is a relatively small country with only 17 million inhabitants, that's what generated also my drive to go abroad and to develop myself and the brands that I work for outside of that country.
Let me tell you, I love the people from Holland. I mean, I have so many fans from all over the world, and they're like my biggest fans. I mean, I just put on my blog, I put an article like, can someone please send me wrist shots of their watches? And all of a sudden, I had 4,000 wrist shots in about 10 minutes, and they were all from Holland.
Oh, that's cool.
And I was like, wow, this is really cool, and I love your people even more for it, so...
They're very engaged, yeah, that's for sure.
And they're super nice, and you know, for anyone who hasn't been to that part of the world, you should definitely take a trip. But, you know, I think the interesting part, too, for you is, you know, to grow up in a family business and see how this has sort of developed and evolved. Like, can you take me through that a little bit? Like, when you first got into it, were you like, this is not even anywhere near what I want to do with my life, or were you like... This is actually kind of cool and interesting. I like it.
No, absolutely. I mean, the latter one, I enjoyed it really, really from the first day, and I started really out on the road selling watches to retailers. And as I said, Zenith was the first brand that I started working with. Also a brand that in those days, they were just recovering still from the quartz crisis. So it was a very interesting times. And then about a year after I started working, it was taken over. It was acquired by the LVMH group. So that's really when they started to invest in it and really have a strategy. So I mean, I went through all of that, and it has been a very interesting time. And I mean, yeah, working with family is like anything, has its ups and its downsides. But I mean, I have nothing but positive memories of those days. And as I said, you know, really, really learned a lot with my father, at the time had like 30 years of experience in the industry, knew all the retailers very well, had a very good relationship with them, and so it's been definitely a very interesting learning school. And I must say we were very successful with Zenith. We were successful with Frederic Constant. We were successful with IWC, of course, because by then it had been about 15 years that my father had been building it with his team. So it was really already at a very developed nothing but positive memories. Absolutely.
Well, what a great way to start with, you know, Zenith, who's arguably one of the best chronograph makers in the entire world. I mean, they made the movement for the Rolex Daytona for a long time, and it's one of the most sound movements in the world. I mean, you know, I'm sure you must be like completely like, you know, overwhelmed by, you know, even Zenith's path and their trajectory over the years with how they've evolved as a brand and where they've gone and where they are now. And again, I think a lot of companies go through those hiccups, ups and downs, ups and downs, ups and downs. And it seems like Zenith has gone through that a lot. So, you know, for you to see it kind of after the quartz crisis, you must have a really, really good perspective of, you know, not just Zenith, but the way the watch industry works in general.
Yeah. Of course, it's very interesting and it can be very fun and you know, exciting to work for a well-established brand. But for me personally, it's much more interesting to work for a brand or work with a brand that is not so developed, which actually then gives it a lot, you know, creates a lot of opportunity to really influence the development and to really make your put a stamp on what you are doing. So for me, that has always been very interesting. And yeah, as you say, Zenith really went from, because I remember when we started, they did like $2,500 gold-plated watches with printed alligator straps on it. And then, 3-4 years later, it had really turned around completely. With the El Primero, with the Chronomaster, with all these beautiful collections, and then it went to a climax with sports watches, and then when there was a new CEO, it started to come down a little bit again in terms of designs and everything. So I totally agree. It's very interesting to see those developments within brands and not just watch brands. I mean, with any brand, with any company that goes through this type of developments, it's very interesting to see.
And then do you feel like I mean, I know because I've been in the watch industry myself for over 20 years. I mean, it's a very small industry. Everybody knows each other. You know, the president of Zenith tomorrow could be the president of Seiko today. You know, it's that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Do you feel that those relationships that were like, you know, this watch industry, the watch industry is based on relationships like any other industry, but specifically the watch industry. Do you feel like, I don't know, like just being in the watch industry yourself and being a president of two brands, you know, for two Americas, if you will, do you feel like those relationships are getting less and less and it's more about, you know, numbers more than it is relationships? Because I feel that it is, and I'm no longer really in the industry from a sales standpoint as much as I am from a journalistic standpoint. So I have a very interesting perspective now. I can see it on both sides. What do you feel about that?
Well, that's an interesting question. You know, fact is that the industry has definitely professionalized itself over the past years. Because 10 years ago, it was really, of course, it was about selling as much as you can. But it was, as you say, it was much more about emotion and about relationships and about having a good partnership. And I think if you look at it, I believe if you look at it today, it's much, much, much more driven by numbers and by hard decisions. Of course, this is also partly generated by the fact that a lot of brands have been absorbed by groups that are traded on the stock exchange, and that obviously generates a different type of decision making than an independent or a family owned brand. But that also makes actually a nice bridge to my point, because we are, you know, Frederick Constein and Alpina are still privately held. And even though we have also gone through that professionalization, and we're doing that on a daily basis, but for us as a company, really relationships and building long-term partnerships with our partners, with our clients, is really still one of the leading elements in our development and in our success also, if you will.
Well, that's good to hear, because honestly, that kind of thing is definitely not lost on me. I mean, listen, it's all about relationships. If I didn't know Lisa, I wouldn't be having this interview with you today. So, to me, it's all about relationships. And that's how anything is built, you know. Do you feel that, you know, Frederick Constant and Alpina, do you feel like these two brands would ever, you know, sell to a major conglomerate like LVMH or Richemont or Swatch Group? Do you feel like that's in the cards, or do you think that, you know, it's going to stay privately held and that's the way it's going to be?
You know, the company is owned by Peter and Aletta Stas, a Dutch couple, and they are so passionately involved in their company and in their brands and in developing the brands and the success that I honestly don't see them selling the company in the next, I don't know, 10, 15, 20 years. You know, they've also openly expressed that to some people inside the company, that that's really not their ambition, that they're not doing it for the money, but they're really doing it because they are so involved and engaged And proud also of the success that they're having, and they're not interested to sell the company or the companies. So I honestly don't see that happening anytime soon.
That's good news as well, because that makes the brands completely autonomous. And,
exactly.
And that's very important, and that translates to the customer as well. You know,
mm-hmm.
And I mean, you know, how involved are you in designing or, you know, putting your stamp on, you know, models that are, you know, that are in the Alpina and Frederick Constant collection?
Well, I mean, I have, before I became president for the Americas, which was about a year ago when I relocated to the US. Before that, I was living in Geneva for 5 years, and I was the global commercial director. So in that position, I of course had influence in the designs and in the new collections, and I still have today. And definitely, you know, I make suggestions but I think that what is even more important is the consistency that you find in the designs of both our collections for Alpina and Frederick Constant, is really mainly because of something that I feel is unique. And that is that Peter and Aletta are really the main responsible for the designs of our products. And they have been since they started the company in 1988. And now in 2013 and the collection for 2014 and 2015, which we are working on already, they still are leading in that process. And that consistency that is generated by that fact, I strongly feel is one of our elements for the success that we're experiencing.
Well, let me tell you this. I'm obsessed with the Extreme Diver. I'm obsessed with the new one with the orange in it. It's absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
So if you want to throw one my way, I'm not going to say no. I really, really love it. I think honestly for the money, especially on a rubber strap, it's like under $1,400.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
What an amazing value. I mean, it's amazing how I've never seen like a diver's watch with that sort of, you know, analog date that's almost reminiscent of an altimeter, like on a pilot's watch. And that's really cool. And you can even see the kind of, I mean, tell me if I'm wrong, even in your pilot's watch, which in my opinion is absolutely an outstanding watch for the money. I think it's in the $4,000 range, $4,000 to $5,000 range, the pilot.
Well, depends which one. I mean, we have a quartz chronograph starting at around $1,000, and then it goes up for the automatic chronograph to around $3,000.
Yeah, I mean, that's amazing, and it's you can definitely see some influence from IWC in there, which I love. That's, you know, to me, that's that is the true Pilot's watch out there. But I think for the money, I don't think I've seen a better finished watch really than Alpina. I think it's very underrated.
Yeah. No, yeah, I mean, I agree. You know, and in regards to the resemblance with other brands, I mean, what you shouldn't forget also is that, you know, in the early 1900s, there were like, I don't know, maybe 150 brands that produced Pilot watches, that designed and produced Pilot watches. And a Pilot watch has a few very simple and strong characteristics for it to be called
a Pilot watch. Yep.
And, of course, IWC is the brand that has always continued producing Pilot watches. And that's why people reference IWC for Pilot watches. But, I mean, Alpina is one of those 150 brands that did Pilot watches in 1910, 1920 for the first and then later for the Second World War. So, you know, and, you know, the satinized case, the matte black dial, the white Arabic luminescent numbers, the white triangle at the 12 o'clock position, those are all basic characteristics of a Pilot watch. So, and if it doesn't have that, then it's not considered a Pilot watch.
No, it's absolutely true. And I think you're right. I think IWC made it iconic, if you will.
Exactly.
And I think that's why everybody references it. But I know, I mean, during the time of World War II, I mean, the big Pilot's watch as we know it today was made by three manufacturers: Glashütte Original, IWC, and Lange & Söhne. And none of them were stamped with anyone's name on the dial. The only way you knew was when the watchmaker opened the movement, it would have the movement manufacturer's name on it. So I'm totally aware with that, but I think you guys do a fantastic job. I mean, where do you see the evolution of this brand? I mean, and how many points of sale are in the United States at the moment? Let's start with Alpina, for instance.
I see a very positive development for both brands. We've seen it in the past years, and this growth is ongoing. The interesting thing is that Frédéric Constant at the moment is bigger in terms of volume than Alpina, even though Alpina is almost 100 years older than Frédéric Constant, because Alpina is now 130 years old, and Frédéric Constant is only between brackets 25 years old. So I definitely see a very positive evolution and development. And to your other question, at the moment we have about 65 doors in the USA selling Alpina, offering Alpina. And for Frédéric Constant, we are now at around 175. So then there's Canada and the Caribbean, but those are separate numbers.
So that it's fairly exclusive, and like how many, and you know, which leads me to my next question, like, you know, how is like the Swiss's mandate about, you know, everyone producing sort of their own in-house movements, and, you know, with the Swatch Group having sort of a monopoly and it not being fair and all that stuff. How has that affected your business?
This has actually affected our company in a positive way.
Good.
And the reason I'm saying that is because we are one of the brands, and especially one of the fewer independent brands, that has already started in-house movement development and production in 2001. So we were not really surprised by what is going on at the moment in Switzerland, because at some point it was kind of bound to happen. But besides that, we have been, you know, we have now 12 years of experience with the development of in-house movements, and that actually puts us in a position where we can supply at least part of our sales. We can supply ourselves. Of course, we are still dependent on external distributor. External suppliers. But you know, at least we have that experience, and we don't need to take some type of urgent last minute decisions to start a project like that. So, yeah, I mean, it really has affected us in a positive way. And what is great about it also is that the market really appreciates us for the fact that we have our in-house movement, especially because we do it at a price point that is really, well, you can say it's unheard of in the industry. There's no other brand that has an in-house movement, Swiss movement, at a price of $2,500 retail.
I mean, we can't count Swatch, right? But yeah, I mean, absolutely. It's there's nobody that comes close for the level of finishing and for the price point. There's no one. Which leads me to another question. Does that create a new business for you to supply other companies with your movements?
For the moment, we really need our own production for our own watches, because the brands are both in a growth phase still. But again, I mean, you never know what the future brings, and as we develop and as we get more experience, it could be something that would happen in the future. But it's too early for us to do that.
And how do you market your brand in the United States, worldwide? Is it, I know different brands have different campaigns for different countries because, you know, people react differently in different markets. Like,
yeah.
do you think that, has social media played an important role for you guys, or is that something that you're kind of still still kind of messing around with?
Well, I mean, one of the main ways for us to develop the brand is, as we discussed at the beginning of the conversation, is really it's only one part of social media. It's the social part, by building relationships with retailers and by building relationships with the people that work at the retailers, that has really been a strong driver of our success. Because if they like the brand, if they appreciate the brand, if they like the people that are behind the brand, they will be much more likely to offer it to their clients. Of course, quality and everything needs to be as it should be, but I feel that's not an issue. So that has really been a very strong driver of our growth, to work with the right retailers, to train them, to inform them, to engage them, to excite them, and then to have them offer the product to their final consumer as a fresh, as a fresh take on the Swiss watch industry. So that's definitely important. And for the rest, of course, we do our advertising campaigns, and definitely social media has also become important and will grow further. Of course, our website, we have multiple websites. We have our frederikkelstrand.tv. We have our Facebook page. We have our Twitter. We have our YouTube channel. So we do all these things. This generates excitement and this generates demand from the final consumer. So and that's definitely something that we're developing further. We've also hired in Geneva, for instance, recently a new social media manager to take charge of those tasks. There's definitely that digital element in our advertising and our promotion campaigns that is becoming more and more important.
Yeah, I think it is important. I will say one thing that, look, everyone in the world may not know who or what Alpina or Frederik Constant is, but the ones that do, I mean, I've never heard a single bad thing about either one of the brands. And I mean, I'm a gearhead. I love the high-end brands and I love the low-end brands. And I'll tell you one thing. You guys are in a very good position because of your price point. And I'm sure you can see this now with the return of Tudor to the United States, which will be launching in roughly a month's time or less, officially. It's going to break open the doors of the intra luxury market.
Yeah.
And I think that's only going to help your brand. What do you think about that?
No, I agree. I mean, I think it's a great development. It's a development that makes sense. And a lot of people, because when we opened our subsidiary here in the US, it was the end of 2008. So I'm sure you remember those times, because everything was it looked like as if the world was falling apart.
Yep.
And then 2009 was really our first full year here, and you know, you could look at it like, wow, that's a very unfortunate timing and very bad timing, and wow, didn't you people have asked me, didn't you think about delaying this project? But you know, now a few years after the fact, people are actually saying, you know, that timing was just perfect.
Because it was
the start of people, you know, the end of all the madness, where just any company, any person could introduce any watch and put any price tag on it and sell it to any client. I mean, that madness really stopped a little bit in those years, and people started to much more appreciate the intrinsic value of the products that they were purchasing. It can be luxurious, and it can be, you know, it can be show off, but still there needs to be a real value and a real story behind it. And I personally feel that with both our brands, we have a perfect answer to that demand. And I'm sure that Rolex and Tudor are seeing the same, and for that reason are relaunching the brand in North America.
I mean, it's a brilliant move on Rolex's part to launch it. It's almost eerie how, you know, we're arguably coming out of a depression. Some people say we're still in it. We're getting further in it. Who the hell knows? But all I can tell you is this, is that, you know, Rolex launched Tudor out of the Great Depression as a secondary option to people, because people wanted lower price points and they still wanted a Rolex. The way I see it now is the product is fantastic. I think people are going to respond very well to it. And it's going to draw a lot of attention to the other brands in that price point.
Yep.
And that's what's exciting for me. That, yep, you know, I haven't felt this way about a brand since Panerai came out, you know, 12, 13 years ago. And it was affordable. It was accessible. Yep. It was affordable. It was fun to collect. And I think that now people are going to seriously start looking not just at Rolex or Tudor, but they're going to look at Alpina, they're going to look at Frederick Constant, and they're going to say, wow, I never knew these brands existed.
Yeah, it definitely adds credibility to the category. That's that I totally agree on. Also because there's not that many brands in the same category that's, you know, that have that same power and that have that same impact.
Which is a great power to have in such a short period of time. So, you know, kudos to you guys for that. And
Thank you.
And what is the strongest market for both brands, would you say?
Well, I mean, we have multiple markets that are strong for us. I mean, Russia is historically has been a very strong market for Frédéric Constant. China is strong. Japan is strong. North America is definitely up there and has developed very quickly in only 4 or 5 years' time. France is important. So, I mean, that's a little bit like Switzerland, by the way, which is also very interesting that we've been able to develop in the markets that is driven by Swiss brands that produce Swiss watches. There came those two Dutch people that started their own brands and against all odds became successful, and also in Switzerland were very successful. And for Alpina, North America is definitely leading there. France is also strong. But with Alpina, we're really in a much different phase, and we're really in the phase of a revival and a development. But we all felt in the management team that the US or North America is really a very logical market for Alpina to be successful.
Absolutely, because you guys, I mean, Alpina, quote me if I'm wrong, I mean, they're really the ones who specialize in sports watches.
Mm-hmm.
And America is known for buying sports watches.
Exactly.
High-end
exactly.
Luxury sports watches. So, yep. I mean, and it must be nice that both brands are completely different and autonomous and unique, and yet they probably complement each other as well.
Yeah, no, totally. You're totally right. I couldn't have said it better. Absolutely.
And do you plan to expand to like India or bigger markets like that?
Well, we already are in India. I mean, with Fennekulstan, we're now in about 110 countries around the world. India is one of them. Brazil is one of them, where we are also developing very strongly. I mean, basically, in all of Latin America, except a few smaller markets where we don't have representation. But in almost all of these markets, we are represented, and business is growing at a very high pace. So yeah, I mean we are in most of these markets. We have
you have a presence there.
We have distributed in Africa. I mean, really all over the world. We are present. And Alpina is a little bit behind that development, but that's really because we want to focus on some key markets, which we can then use as a foundation to continue building.
And do you plan on having any like celebrity endorsements or ambassadors or anything like that to sort of drive the brand more in the U.S.?
Well, we do have a few already like that. So we've been working in China with a young lady called Suchi, and she has been our brand endorser for the past 5 years, and that has been very successful. You may not know her, but. By far, most Chinese people or Asian people that are interested in the good things in life, in luxury, etc., they for sure know her. She actually played a role in the Transporter a few years ago.
Oh,
but
cool!
She's really a big star in Asia. So on that part of the world in the East, we do have that. And then for Fennekulstan, our ladies' collection has always been very important. And we have Ines Sastre, who is a model, she's our brand ambassador, and together with her we promote our support to the World Heart Federation. And then for Alpina, we have one of the Baldwin brothers, William Baldwin.
Yep.
It's also who endorses our diving collection since last year, and with him we've also done a few cool, very cool events. And so that definitely creates excitement. And
does it help sell the brand though? Do you feel like it's helped, you know, build awareness and sort of highlight some key things that the brand has to offer?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, it creates a story and it creates brand awareness, and then eventually, ultimately, it will also drive sales for sure. But you know. Here also, what I think is important to know is that we as a brand, also as part of our values, we want to create the most beautiful watch at the most reasonable price. And if we would start to hire or to appoint brand ambassadors that cost a few million dollars a year, the only way for us to do that is. To increase is by increasing our retail prices.
Yeah.
So that, you know, that collides a little bit with our initial vision and our initial strategy to offer the most beautiful, most beautifully finished and manufactured product at the most reasonable price possible.
Hey, Ralph, I'm always available, you know? I mean, I'm just saying.
We can talk about it offline.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a Baldwin, but it doesn't matter. Like, I really love your brands, and I have a lot of respect for them. And, I think you do great work. What is your approach to, you know, making your own boutiques? Do you think you're going to do that? Do you think it's going to be effective? Or do you think you want to stay, you know, in retail partners?
Well, we do have a small number of boutiques already in some markets. We have in China, we have in Hong Kong, we have in Saudi Arabia, we have in Seoul, in South Korea. So we do have a few of those, and we have a few others. In the Western world, we don't have any boutiques yet, and we will. In the next few years, we will develop a few of those. But it's not for us as a brand and as a company. It's not a key priority. Our key priority is really to build relationships with our multi-brand retailers, and to really have a good positioning there. So our focus is much more on shop-in-shops and in-store boutiques than on standalone brand boutiques. So that's our strategy, and I know that's a little bit different than a lot of other brands. But I mean,
but it works for you. I mean, you got to do what works, right? You can't just follow everybody's. You know, because you're a completely different brand from the other brands that are doing boutiques. So,
and doing things in a different way has paid off for us as a company. So we have no reason to start following others, but we like to keep doing our own thing and try to be as successful as possible with it.
Well, you heard it from the horse's mouth himself, Ralph. It was an absolute pleasure talking to you today.
Thank you.
I appreciate the opportunity, and we will be in touch very soon, and I'll let you know further details.
Okay, great. I mean, thank you very much for your time, and I love doing this. Thank you.
You're very kind. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Well, there you have it, folks. That was my one-on-one candid interview with the president of Alpina and Frederick Constant Watches, Ralph Simons. I want to thank him for his time and for giving a hell of an interview. You can check out both Frederick Constant and Alpina Watches on their respective websites. I also want to thank Shalboy Music and Flipside for providing the tracks for this podcast. If you want to find out what's going on with me, you can check out my website at www.amitdevhonda.com. You can also check out my Instagram, my Twitter, and my Facebook. And until we meet again, rock on and fly back.